Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is the Book Riot Podcast. It's a weekly news and talk show about what's new, cool, and worth talking about in the world of books and reading. We're recording on Thursday, June 30th, 2022. I'm Jeff O'Neill, here with Rebecca Shinsky, coming to you from BookRiot.com. It's the last day of the first half of the year. Does this mean anything to you?
No.
Yeah. June 20th means something to me, but not this.
Yeah, like the summer solstice, the start of summer, that all means something to me. Just in that feels like, okay, the longest day of the year, the most sunlight. It's like really summer weather, kind of no matter where you are in the country. But just the end of June being halfway through the year doesn't mean anything to me usually, other than like, oh crap, we're already halfway through.
Yeah, it's not like turning 40. It'd be like looking at your actuarial table and say, oh, I'm expected to live to 88.7 years. I mean, like at 44.35, you know, let's mark this somehow.
Yeah, I have had that existential moment this year about turning 40 and like the literal meaning of midlife.
Yes.
but I'm not having it about the midpoint of the year so far.
Yeah, though I should say this, we are going to use as the occasion to demarcate one half of the other. And so for our bonus Patreon episode this week, which we're going to record right after this episode, but we're going to talk about our favorite reads, our favorite books we've read so far this year. My front list foyer adventure has yielded interesting dividends in this regard. And I've read 75 books so far this year, and I got my list down to 12. I usually only like to recommend about one out of every 10 books I read. I feel like I'm really recommending good stuff. I don't want to be a promiscuous book recommender. I don't know why I care about this, but this is something I care about. And so usually, so that would give me 7, you know, basically bites at the apple. But you can hear me be worried about adding extra 5 and do my dance of keeping to constraints that nobody but me cares about for reasons that are even beyond my ken at this point. So that's coming next. But I want to talk about, is there a book of the year? What are the candidates for book of the year? And what actually we mean by that. But we'll come back after our first sponsor to talk about that.
Today's episode is brought to you by National Geographic Books. So take a second, think to yourself, what is one of the like weirdest, but kind of interesting, intriguing, intelligent animals that you know of? If you, like me, think of an octopus, then Secrets of the Octopus by Cy Montgomery is the book for you. It is a beautifully illustrated book that explores the underwater world of the octopus, a creature that resembles an alien life form, but whose behavior has earned it a reputation as one of the most intelligent animals on the planet. This journey into the world of the octopus reveals how large their brains are. They occupy their whole body, not just their heads. They can adjust their genetic makeup to respond to the demands of the environment. So with this book, you can see how the octopus can change shape and color to camouflage themselves more effectively than any other species. They are cool AF. So learn about all of this and more in Secrets of the Octopus. And thanks again to National Geographic Books for sponsoring this episode.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Speaking of things I don't know that anybody else besides me cares about, maybe people do, but like, the book of the year, we've talked about this phrase in the past, that is some chimera of popular, well-regarded, good, important, like it has to be a little of all those categories to be a book of the year or one of the books of the year. I guess when we were really doing our power ranking of books of 2000, this really came to the fore there, where you have to have a little bit of all the ingredients to make it in there. And I think it's a fun idea. Maybe one way of thinking about it is like if you were to forecast into 10 years from now, 20 years, in this case, 22 years from now, are there any sort of sleeper picks you would pick? You know, or you buy low, sell high is kind of a fun game to play with these things as well. I've done a little bit of thinking about this because I have, and I threw this at you literally 45 seconds before we started recording. And for this reason alone, does anything jump out at you? If you think of Book of the Year, does anything at all even like enter the arena to be knocked down at this point in the year?
It doesn't. And I'll say, like, as I was prepping for the Patreon episode about my favorites of the year so far, I was just also thinking, like, well, what are the books of the year, even if they're not my favorites? And it doesn't necessarily have to be a new release to be a book of the year. Like, Crawdads was the big book in the year after the year in which it was published.
Yeah.
So kind of loosening those constraints. But I think the story this year so far is that the big books are the books that have gotten big on TikTok, and most of those are backlist.
Yeah.
So, you know, Colleen Hoover's doing great. Taylor Jenkins Reid is doing great. But I don't consider those really books of the year. It also doesn't seem to have like broken out beyond what's happening on TikTok necessarily. That's just such a big thing in and of itself. So my answer is no. And I think that might be different. I hope that's different by the end of the year. Often the book of the year comes out in the fall in Oscar book season. If we're going to get one, there are some biggies coming out this fall. So I think it's possible that we will have a different answer by our final show of December. But so far, no.
I think you're right. It has to be the Colleen Hoover corpus, right? Basically, all of her books are selling in the top. There's a bunch, but like three to four of them are routinely appearing in the best-selling books of the week in Publishers Weekly every week. And some of them you're actually intensifying. And It Ends With Us sold 58,000 copies last week. That's more than it did 3 weeks ago. Sidebar for just a second. Do you know what It Ends With Us is about?
I have absolutely no idea.
Yeah, I've kept myself. At some point, I have no idea either. So maybe when we should record what we guess it's about at this point. That would be a fun game to embarrass ourselves with, but I've kept the mental cellophane on It Ends With Us for a while.
Mental cellophane is a good show title.
A couple of candidates here. I think it has to have at least appeared somewhere towards the top of the bestseller list at this point for me to consider it. I think the one, if I had to pick, that has some hipster cred, it is a good book. And it sold relatively well, though it's fallen out of the top 20 for hardcover fiction. I think it might be Sea of Tranquility. It's a kind of a weak contender. Not because I don't think it's good, but it just hasn't, you know, it just hasn't, yeah, doesn't have, I, people aren't out there reading it. Civilians aren't really recommended to each other, which is,
as you know, I really liked Sea of Tranquility, but I don't think we could rubber stamp it as the book of the year so far.
No, I think
coming into this year, I would have guessed it would either maybe be that or The Candy House by Jennifer Egan. Really, those are the two big name releases we've had so far this year that I thought had potential to have like that level of sparkle, I guess. Nothing sticky so far for Book of the Year.
I think, and I looked at a little bit of, like, some people have done, I think Book Riot is doing our own best of the year so far next week or the week after. We'll spend some time on that one specifically. And we've done the Amazon and Barnes & Noble list. I look at some of the, like, higher profile editorial things like Vulture and Esquire and the BBC and Pals and NPR. You know, there's a couple of names. Olga Dye's Dreaming pops up a lot. I've been seeing that a lot. That book didn't super work for me, but that's kind of beyond the scope of what the book of the year. It doesn't matter if I liked it or not. Things can be book of the year whether or not I like it or not, or completely fall off the radar or never have been on the radar, even if I really love something, which is all too common. The other one, you know, To Paradise, I think, is having a little bit of resurgence maybe in showing up on these lists. There was a little bit of Hanya Yanagihara backlash, hater, troll. I'm not sure.
A lot of discourse.
Yes. A lot of detractors, I think, is fair. To say, though I don't think the detraction is necessarily fair. As I've said on this show before, I've said to you before, and it continues to be true, that book continues to grow in my mind as I read more things that seem like trying to do something similar or, you know, multiple timelines, spec fic back and forth. Like, oh yeah, To Bear Advice was just more interesting than these books that I'm reading now. So for me, I wonder if there's going to be a late kind of charge at some point.
Maybe it'll have a moment during award season.
Yeah. But, you know, the version of that, I mean, talk about it, you know, when you see it, the version of this we would know when we see A Book of the Year would be A Little Life when that came out, right? To speak of Yanniga. Or it was up there. Like, if A Little Life phenomenon was out now, we would be saying that's the book of the year right now. Just all the sales and talk and discourse and tears. And it also occurred to me that maybe in the spaces where you and I don't dwell a lot, whether it is Book Talk or Bookstagram or Tumblr or other like more extremely online sources of book excitement, if there are some new releases that are more picked up than others, I think it would show up in the sales though, right? I'm looking at the sales. So I just think the backlist power, especially with Book Talk right now, is so formidable that it's really drowning out new releases, because new releases haven't had the time for people to read them yet and to be picked up, and debut authors especially, where then you can't then go buy all the Colleen Hoovers, and then Colleen Hoover gets book deals for her self-published stuff, that comes up a little bit. So yeah, I really don't know that there's a book of the year. I mean, looking down, yeah, you're right, the fall is a murderer's row again, as it normally is. We're even getting some stuff in the late half of the summer we should talk about it sometime, coming out soon, but I think the belt is there to be won for somebody. I don't think you have to knock a champ out to get the belt for Book of the Year so far. Okay. Story of the Year, though, I think absolutely continues to be the intensified gall of those on the right to challenge, ban, censor, harass, and intimidate books, especially by and about LGBTQ plus authors. The close to home to you in Virginia, we followed this case about Barnes & Noble being sued for genderqueer and the Sarah J. Maas book. I think it's just the first one. I don't think the other books have been named any of these at this point. But counterclaims, lawyers saying the obscenity claims of Virginia are now defective and should be tossed out. I don't know the legal term of art, but that sounds right to me. It feels like defective and should be tossed out. I agree.
Yes.
I just gaveled that to be true. Let's go.
Wonderful. Court of Rightness now in session.
Yes, Court of Rightness in session.
More on the more technical end, they explain in this PW piece that functionally it says the petition and the show for cause are facially defective because the Virginia law doesn't authorize a court to declare that a book is obscene for unrestricted viewing by minors. So the Virginia law can't constitutionally be the basis of the complaint that the petitioner is making, because the state doesn't allow them to, like, you can't complain about the thing they're complaining about, basically.
That's defective, I guess.
Which,
huh?
It is defective. I think this is one of those cases that brings out my most cynical readings of things, and I think for good reason, that I think they knew this going in, that this is a defective claim. It's not about actually trying to win the case. It's about the publicity that having done it, it garners for this candidate, to drum up, you know, frustration and whatever else they're trying to drum up support on the far right for. Look at how I'm fighting this culture war for you, and is a continuing illustration of the ways in which the folks on that far right end of things are much more interested in publicity than they are in actual governance. I'm willing to believe, I fully do believe, that they knew going in that this wasn't going to go anywhere. And they're probably fine with that. They're not actually trying to ban the book. They're trying to get the attention, to win the election, to gain the power that then they can attempt to make other kinds of changes where, you know, control a school board. You don't have to try to change the definition of obscenity. That was the most, I think, important sentence of this to me. It was like, oh, right, yeah. These jokers knew going in that this wasn't going to work. They don't care. This is not the game they're playing. They're playing a publicity game.
Speaking of counter moves that we like, a librarian in Canada, her name is Bessie Sullivan, the CEO of the Orilla Public Library in Ontario. CEOs in Canada, libraries in Canada have CEOs. That's interesting.
Great question.
Chief excitement officer, Canadian excellent.
Enthusiast.
Canadian enthusiast officer. Basically, they were having a drag queen story hour, and there were some protests. And she said, you know what? Rather than cowing to this or worrying about it, we're going to add more to the docket. We're doubling down. We're doing another show, another reading, and there we go. Not much else to say about this. Now, again, you can do these because these are online attacks, it looks like, and people don't actually show up in person. Mm-hmm. It's a different deal that we see in some of this stuff, especially in Texas. I think it was the year before yes. last, mm-hmm. where people were showing up. Someone had a gun at some point, you know, making threats. Mm-hmm. So it's easy. I don't want to say that people who are really experiencing physical threats should or could, or even I want them to do this. But in these cases where you're calling someone's bluff, if you see it as a bluff, call it, do some more, and show them that you're Streisand affecting yourself into oblivion here a little bit. So that's Bessie Sullivan yes. in Ontario. May your efforts succeed.
May your efforts succeed.
Okay. You know, let's see. Two tech things. I want to go to... I had initial reaction to this headline about authors protesting Amazon policy that allows Kindle users to return books within 7 days. And then I read the piece and I got turned around on it, Rebecca.
Me too. That's exactly okay. what happened to me.
So were we both on the same mental page that we didn't know that we were on? Is like, get over it, authors, initially. This is a thing that people can do. Is that where you were? It's like, yeah, yes. It's too bad? Okay.
Yeah, I think we've seen enough of like enough petitions from the Authors Guild about things that it's like, oh, come on.
You're right. Maybe that's not fair, but I have to get through an oh, come on barrier before I can take any of this yes, seriously.
But I did get turned around by the piece. And this is a piece from NPR by Deanna Schwartz. So I guess I didn't realize that this was a thing you could do on Kindle. I've not done this, but for listeners who are catching up with us, what's going on is that Kindle allows users to return an ebook for a refund within 7 days of purchasing it. And the thing is, like, you can say that you accidentally bought, like, it was an accidental purchase. I didn't mean to buy this book. The problem is that 7 days is plenty long for many people to read a book and then return it. And this functionality, I guess, loophole, however you want to see it, is something that people have been, I guess, calling out and offering as a tip or a trick to online reading communities. It's often packaged. Mm-hmm, yeah. Schwartz says it's often packaged as a way to like stick it to Amazon. But what's actually happening is like you're not really sticking it to Amazon. You're sticking it to the author, because when the ebook gets returned, the royalties that were paid to them when you made the purchase are also deducted. So authors have discovered that this is going on by getting their monthly royalty statements from Amazon and seeing like, oh, I didn't make any money this month. I actually lost money because people have been buying my book and then returning it, and that it's happening at a much higher volume than usual, at a much higher rate. This is people not acting in good faith.
Nope.
And I had a very, by the end of the piece, I had a very like, this is why we can't have nice things kind of response. Like Schwartz also notes that this is unusual, that the other major ebook retailers, Barnes & Noble, Kobo, don't offer a similar policy. Amazon's is a standout from the other big brands. Like Kobo and Apple iBooks both require that you have to contact customer service to see if an item is eligible for refunds. Barnes & Noble and Smashwords don't allow any ebooks to be returned. And ebooks are also the only digital product that Amazon allows customers to return. So I don't know what the intention behind the policy is. Probably, if we assume that Amazon was trying to act in good faith for its customers, the intention is probably people do accidentally click things and we want to give them a way to return them. But it's being treated as a loophole. People are certainly taking advantage of it. And now folks from the authors are joining together to sort of protest this. They want Amazon to change the policy. Looks to me like their suggestions are reasonable. Like maybe if a person has read less than 20% of the book, they can return it. But if you have completed the book, which Amazon can certainly detect, you cannot return it. That's, I think, more than reasonable. You can't walk into your Barnes & Noble with a paperback that has been clearly like carried around in a backpack for a week and get a refund. Believe me, I know, because people used to try it.
So. Yeah, I think that's part of it, is the durability of digital goods makes it so that you can't wear out the book and it's easy to return. There is friction. And even if you did read the book without cracking the spine, you still got to drive your butt back over there and go up the thing. So there's a little friction to do it as well. I think there's the particulars and the general are both interesting here, that Amazon does seem to be an outlier in both within its own ecosystem, right? Yeah. That you can't, you can't buy, say, I don't know, what movies are just coming out? Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness as a digital movie and then watch it and return it, apparently. I've never tried this myself. Now, one difference, though, is that eventually, if you wait long enough, you can rent that sucker, which does mm-hmm. not exist in books. But what does exist in books for the waiters who want to get it for cheaper is the library, which is noticed here, right? And so kind of it feels like the ethical waterfall here in most of our minds is it's okay to get the book from your library to for free. And you just yes. wait long enough, right? Someone's paid for that. You know, we've talked not ad nauseum, but at near nauseum about, you know, the library licensing argument, which has died out, by the way. Have you
I
haven't seen that in a while. So that's Mm-mm. something I hadn't really thought about because it hasn't been in the zeitgeist at all, at least in our little part of the world. And then from there, it's like, okay, you also have the opportunity, if you wait and if you're vigilant, to get an ebook deal, right? I just recommended to someone Lost and Found by Catherine Schultz because on the Book Riot Daily Deals newsletter, it was $1.99. And I was like, go buy that, which is essentially a rental kind of a price for a book, except you get to keep it, which is interesting as well. But these are people who don't want to spend money, and they found a loophole, and they're abusing it. It sounds like it's picked up relatively recently. And though there's no direct blame given here, I think our baseline, our Bayesian prior here should be a weird new vertical spike in behavior is a book talk phenomenon, right? If it's true of sales, it might be true of this as well. It does say, one of Chad Ryan, who's a fantasy writer, says, my hope is that readers will understand that influencers on TikTok and discussions on Facebook may have all the angles figured out, but it's not only Amazon they're hurting here. I don't know. Maybe there are Facebook groups about thrifting or getting free books and cheap books. That's possible. I know there's people that those are usable groups that people do. So this is a tragedy of the common situation. Not enough people knew about it, and it wasn't being promoted to a certain audience with a certain intent, and we got along fine. And it does feel like something Amazon should do something about. It doesn't seem to me reasonable that you can read a book and return it for free. I don't know where I am on the I started it and hated it thing. Where are you on that? What mechanism would you do you have any idea? Is that anything we can do anything about?
I really, in my heart of hearts, feel like too bad, so sad. And maybe that's a holdover from having worked at a bookstore, or that I still read a lot of my books in print and purchase them. And I do believe, like, once you have cracked a book open, like you have carried it out of my local Barnes and
Noble. You worn the shoes outside. That's the one I always think about. You wore the shoe outside.
I've carried it out of my Barnes and Noble after I do my 3:30 p.m. check-in to see what the teens are talking about. And I've started it. If I don't like it, that is my book. And I can do with it what I want. I can give it away. I can give it to someone else. I can put it on my shelf, whatever. But that's mine. It's mine now. And I understand digital goods are different because there is not wear and tear. But I think our relationship to them, it's helpful for consumers and for retailers if our relationship to those items is relatively consistent. Like, I don't think you can buy an album on iTunes and return it if you don't like the songs. And I remember back in the day when CD stores were a thing, like you could not go to Sam Goody and buy the new Counting Crows CD and then take it back the next day after it was opened and be like, I just didn't like it. That's not a thing. This is the risk you take. It's like it's the risk you take when you order a dish you've never had before at a restaurant. Like maybe it really is awful and you're going to send it back. But most people are going to do the calculus of like, I wanted to try this thing. It just wasn't for me. Okay. It's like sometimes that's the way the cookie crumbles. And I think it's generous of Amazon and Audible and whatever other retailers have any of these loophole options to try to account for the fact that sometimes we do make unintentional purchases. But when they begin being taken advantage of, it really is, bad apples spoiling it for everybody. And I do think these authors' point is well made, and I hope it's well taken, that you're not sticking it to Amazon, you're sticking it to the creators here. And I think especially in the Amazon ecosystem, where if you publish through Amazon, you can get a higher royalty rate if you only publish your ebooks through Amazon, if you don't make them available through other retailers. So there's incentive to only publish through Amazon and get a much higher royalty percentage. But then if readers can just buy your book and read it and send it back to you, you can lose money. And that's a prop. That's a problem with their value proposition that I think Amazon will want to address for authors that are publishing exclusively through them. But yeah, I'm very much, you know, too bad, so sad. You spent your $5.99. That is how being a consumer works. Sometimes you don't like the thing. I don't know.
But digital
and if you
books
don't want to
too,
take the risk, like that's what the library is for.
Yeah, that's what the library is for. And digital lending is easier than ever. I think the idea that I didn't know what it was going to be like and I tried it and I want to send it back does carry some water, but I think with digital books, that's where it carries the least water because I know you can try samples all the live long day.
Mm-hmm.
You can read, I think I do this a lot more now. I try samples of something to see if I want to buy it on a digital book, especially if it's in the front list foyer era. There's a lot of new books and I don't know much about them. There's not a lot of, you know, I'm trying debut authors. I'm trying authors I've never done before. And I'll read the whole sample on Kindle or eBooks and I'll decide at the end, do I want mm-hmm. to proceed and buy it or not? And sometimes I do and sometimes I don't. But I think that's in the spirit of this, what they're trying to let you try it, right? Because it, sight unseen, not only is a huge money commitment, for me, it's an even bigger time commitment. You know, the 6 hours I'm going to spend reading a book is worth, yeah, it costs me yeah. way more than the $12.99
right.
To get in. So I'm really solving for my own time. So that's my thought here is you don't really have an excuse. I think the Amazon buy now with one click, they've created their own problem here with this mm-hmm. idea of an accidental mm-hmm. buy, is that you can, you know, scrolling on your Kindle or scrolling something. That is literally one click and it's done. And I don't know that I've made the mistake of doing it, but I was like, boy, that was awfully easy. They're making, so Amazon is really benefiting from making it super easy. And maybe this is the deal they made with themselves. They realize that in order to make it the friction as low as possible, they need to have a more generous return upon the other side. I've got a solution to this. Would you like to hear it? I thought about this.
I would.
I've got a solution to this.
I have an idea also. So yeah, go
okay.
ahead.
You get two returns a year per account.
Okay.
You can do two. Okay. Within 7 days, no questions asked. You don't abuse it. We can keep track.
Yeah.
We have all your data. You have your account. It's getting, we can keep track of how many times you've done this. Why yep. not give people a couple of, or maybe for every 15 you buy, you get one, you know, maybe like PTO, you can accrue
right.
A get out of jail free card, but we have the technology. Literally, we have the technology.
We literally have it. Yeah.
To see how many, where the abusers are.
Now that we're talking about this, I'm remembering that a couple of years ago, there was a similar problem with Audible because Audible allows you to return
yeah.
ebooks that you've bought with your credits really at any time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that they had then put in some technology to detect people who were doing it routinely, who were just getting books and then returning them so that they could get those credits back, even if they had listened to the titles. My idea was to put a time limit on it that Google, you know, Gmail has the thing where you can unsend an email within like 2 minutes or something.
There you go.
I think it should be something like that, that there is a window of there. I think it's very possible, as you're saying, that people do make accidental purchases because that one click thing, like all you got to do is put your finger in the wrong place one time. And you can account for that. Like you get a confirmation screen of like, congratulations, you have completed your,
you bought this book.
Right. You bought this book. And so there's, I think there should be a button there that's like, oops.
Yeah.
And your oops button is available to you for the next 5 minutes. But if after that time elapses, you're on your own recognizance, man, when you're shopping online or really for anything. And if you have accidentally purchased something and you don't realize it when you get a confirmation screen and a confirmation email, that feels like that's your problem.
Yeah, one of the other solutions offered here, and it's, I don't know if it's better or worse than the, you get three red flags a year to say, I didn't like this, or I did something wrong, or I changed my mind, is since it can monitor, since the Kindle app especially can monitor how much mm-hmm. of a book you've read, and in fact, Kindle Unlimited authors get paid based on how many pages. So this is, you know, tracking what people have read as payment as part of this, to say, once you've got across the 20% mark, you've read that book, and you have passed the point
fair.
Of literal no return. At that moment. And that would make sense to me too. You maybe have to do some education, but I think both of those were thrown in the spirit of, there is some affordance for, boy, this is not a book that's for me. And most of us would agree in the court of rightness that it's okay to return. But this is too permissive. And like many things, if there is an angle to be abused, if exploited and publicized,
yeah.
it will be abused. And that seems to be where we are.
Well, yeah, I think that's very generous, you know, thinking about other forms of media. If you do order Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of whatever,
yeah,
from your, like, from your on demand, cable on demand or whatever, you can't return it if you didn't like it. You cannot get your money back. Like, that's,
yeah, or at least it's onerous. It's not easy to do right in the app, and that's one of the things they say here, is that they make it so easy to do. And I'm opposed to the, you've got to call the New York Times during their two business hours to cancel your subscription thing, right? But that's canceling things into the future. I haven't even consumed the Sunday Times in 3 weeks. I'm trying to get rid of this. That's not what I'm talking about here. It's like, I think there's some fairness to the consumer and some fairness to the creator here. And this is a weird corner case that hasn't been exploited, and now it is, and probably they need to do something about it. Because here's another thing. As much as I rail against ebook pricing, what I do know is that it's cheaper for a publisher to make a digital book than a hardcover. It is not easier for an author to write. That I do know. I do know. So, all right. Let's do another sponsor break and do a little bit more. Speaking of book talk, Barnes & Noble and Book Talk have partnered up for a hashtag book talk challenge. And I'm not even sure if this is interesting anymore. Barnes & Noble is paying for this. What's the money flow? We always try to think about this, of who's getting what from who. I don't think the Book Talk hashtag nor TikTok writ large needs the free pub of Barnes & Noble publicizing this. But it did get me thinking about this, which is, if you look at the big winners of Book Talk, it's the, you know, it's the 10 authors, or maybe it's down to 20 or 30 that really had kind of a life-changing experience. And it's there's a power law thing going on there. But if you're the number 25 beneficiary of the Book Talk surge, I'm sure you're thrilled. But I think Barnes & Noble is the big winner. The big corporate winner here is Barnes & Noble. And this brings it home to me. You and I have been in Barnes & Noble of late. We've shared texted images of Book Talk tables. And the one that really brought home to me, I was in the Strand. I was in New York for vacation with my family. And I walked around the Strand, had a wonderful time there. Really, really got some early 2000s vibes flowing through my body at that point. And even even the Strand had a Book Talk table. And for those of you who don't know, is there a snootier bookstore in America than the Strand? Is there a bigger hipster place in America? No. I don't think, that I've been to.
Yeah. I mean, literally the biggest.
Yeah, literally. Because Powell's is not as snooty, and it's the only one that's even close in size and sort of prestige for one of these big independent bookstores.
Really small, very snooty ones, but
in the Village. You're right. It's probably that's like a gold lettered. You know, it looks like an old English pub on the side.
Right, but in the Venn diagram of like snooty and influential,
yeah,
it's definitely the Strand.
And I texted you the picture of their table, but then also their little, I don't know, bookmarks. They were being very snarky about, I think, even having to have the table was a thing there. It's like, don't ask us, just go. That's right.
Yeah. Great way to appeal to the fans of the thing is be snarky about the fact that you're advertising to them.
Maybe they don't care. They're there to buy It Ends With Us or Circe or The 7.5 Lives of Evelyn Hugo. That's a portmanteau. I know that was a mistake on purpose. Don't email me. And Barnes & Noble is the big winner here, and it seems like they're doubling down on that. And the Barnes & Noble I went to recently didn't just have one book talk table. It had Spicy Talk, which I guess is the erotica, you know, kind of vibes there. Sarah J. Maas had her own table. James Clear had his own table. Colleen Hoover certainly had her own table. There's the YA fantasy book talk table. Just remarkable stuff. And the free advertising Barnes & Noble gets, because the other thing about Book Talk that I've noticed, and other, I'm not the first person to notice this, is it's paper books. It's trade paper is the coin of the realm there, and that's where you go buy it. So, Rebecca, when you're there at 3:30 with all the other high school kids to get your mint caramel frap and to check out what's new, you know, tell us if you see people there for the hashtag Book Talk Challenge. I have to admit, did you read the rest of this article? What is this? Like, what do you do?
Yeah,
what do you get?
You know,
like, what do you even do? I stopped at thinking about Barnes & Noble.
I don't know what, if there's substance to the challenge other than you're between June 29th and August 31st, you're encouraged to share books to share your reaction to books on TikTok using the hashtag #BookTalkChallenge. And the Barnes & Noble displays in store are going to have QR codes that will take you to the new BookTok hub on TikTok, which I think is maybe sneakily the most interesting thing about this, that BookTok is happening enough that it's made it worthwhile for TikTok to create a hub for it.
And it didn't have one already? I'm really surprised.
Apparently not. It says the new BookTok hub. There's a new dedicated BookTok hub on TikTok. So I don't know how new, but it must be pretty new. That's interesting to me that it's big enough. I don't have a TikTok. I'm not familiar enough with it to know how many other hubs there are. Like, how special does a topic have to be to get a TikTok hub? But that seems notable to me. And yeah, Barnes & Noble is definitely the winner here. TikTok doesn't need Barnes & Noble's help getting users or advertising anything. But I think Barnes & Noble is wise to have recognized people are coming into our stores looking for books they saw on TikTok. And we are smart to spend some money encouraging that.
Whatever that looks like.
Right. Especially teens who are, I think, more likely to go into physical stores than they are to have access to like a credit card to buy stuff online. Barnes & Noble is a big, big winner there. And it makes sense to me that they are, you know, trying to build on that for as long as they can. So I'll be interested. You know, I will go to my Barnes & Noble and, you know, scan some QR codes and see what happens.
I didn't have this in the agenda, but that made me remember. I saw a headline yesterday, and I don't have the details here, but it did strike me as, oh, this could be a thing, and I don't know. But the commissioner of the SEC is pressuring, encouraging, suggesting, whatever commissioners, that Apple and Android ban TikTok from their app platforms because of surveillance. ByteDance, which is TikTok's parent company, is a Chinese company and not great about privacy and human rights and national security and everything else that you might be worried. Anything you're worried about with Facebook, let's put it this way.
Yeah.
You know, plus the international stuff.
If you have a piece of tape over your laptop's video camera, you should definitely be worried about TikTok.
Right. If you're running an ad blocker, please throw away your phone right now if you have TikTok on it right now. And I don't know if this, we haven't seen, there's talk about saber rattling, and maybe if there's saber rattling, maybe this is the term to apply. It's a little more than saber rattling, I think, when it comes to banning LGBTQ books in Virginia, like we're seeing. But I think a lot of politicians saber rattle around tech privacy stuff, and, and not much gets done. And I don't follow it closely enough to know, do they not want to do it? They don't want to spend the political capital, even if they could do it, or they can't do it at all because of the law or some other, you know, they don't have the votes, to quote Hamilton. But it does get talked about a lot, and people try to score points by talking tough around tech giants and monopolies and privacy. But boy, it's never, the only one I can think of is a GDPR, which I don't even remember what it stood for, but there was a big privacy thing in Europe a couple of years ago that actually affected our business. Like, we had to do some forwards for it as well. It doesn't really happen. So, you know, does this mean it's going to happen? No, it's not sufficient, but I think you would need, this is a necessary condition, right? You would need to have this kind of thing happen first, this kind of discourse to happen first. And I'd keep a very, very close eye on that, because I think that's, you know, TikTok's dominance is such now, and the geopolitics are such now, that the big fish are going to start being interested in this big fish and what it means.
Yeah, I think there's some scrutiny that needs to be applied, and that I hope the big, you know, tech giants, the Apples and Android, Google, pay some attention to what they find when they conduct whatever scrutiny they're going to conduct. You know, I came off earlier this year watching the Showtime series about Uber, super pumped. And there is a moment in that where, you know, you get to see them deciding to access the cameras and video cameras of drivers' phones to spy on what's happening in cars. And then Apple finding out that Uber is doing some shady things with privacy and taking them out of the store for a couple of days, until at that point Travis Kalanick like goes to Apple and does a song and dance and lies to people's faces, and that's why he's not the CEO anymore, among many other reasons. Not a good dude, that one. But there's precedent for Apple, at least, to have done this on the basis of violation of user privacy in the past. It didn't stick in the long term, but they have done it. So the saber rattling, like, there's a saber, it's not just a rattle.
No, that's right. It's not just a bunch of dry beans in an empty case right here.
To think about it that way, I hope Barnes & Noble has like a plan B around how to continue reaching all these new customers that they have found if TikTok goes away or changes in some fashion, where now Barnes & Noble is really, I think, heavily reliant on the success of those books, given how much real estate they're getting, literal real estate they're getting in the stores. So,
yeah. Yeah. I don't know. It'd be interesting to see, but it does bring to bear, you know, there are meta things going on in that world. And once, and it's influential in a number of fields, in almost every kind of marketing consumer product field that's, you know, people 40 and under are part of it all. It's the thing. I mean, even just riding the subway in New York, like, I'm not around people like this where they're just sitting around. A lot of people just scrolling through TikTok, just sitting there watching videos one after the other. I'm ambivalent about it. I think it's interesting, but it does suggest that there is a tipping point of attention for the powers that be to get interested. Someone I was talking to recently, they were quoting someone else, so I would quote them directly. I knew it says, like, a Chinese company owning TikTok is sort of like a Russian company owning MTV in the 90s or the 80s. And I was like, that wouldn't have stood, right? You know, I don't think we would have let that happen. And I don't know why. I don't know what's different about it. And of course, the parallel isn't direct, as most analogies aren't. But it's in the, you know, it differs in degree, not by kind, yeah, I think.
It passes
the
smell
terms.
Test, I think.
Yeah, very interesting. Okay. Let's do Front List Foyer. Did you read while you were traveling? You had some plane time and some woods time. Did you have any book time?
I had a little book time. I had a lot of rom-coms on the Delta Studio time.
Okay, what were the hits there?
Of the rom-coms?
Yeah, did you watch The Lost City? Michelle
did.
We flew to New York. Yeah, she did that on the flight.
I watched The Lost City. Perfect plane movie.
Yeah.
And I think extra fun if you're a person who knows anything about how romance novels get made. So that was really enjoyable. I watched Marry Me with Jennifer Lopez and Owen Wilson on the flight back. Less perfect, but I love Owen Wilson. So, like, what are you going to do?
You're there for Owen Wilson? You were at Marry Me for Owen Wilson.
I mean, I like J-Lo.
You are the 1%. You are the 1%, Rebecca, truly.
I can't. I've watched too many Wes Anderson movies. What can I say?
That's fine. That's fine.
What can I say? I also watched When Harry Met Sally, because I always watch When Harry Met Sally. I did read one book that Vanessa had. I think Vanessa was like halfway through it when she was guesting with me while you were out on vacation, and I was just about to start it. But it was Who Is Wellness For? By Faria Roizen, who I think was one of my picks for the summer draft. It's really interesting. It's a kind of a mix of memoir, essay, and like sociology history about different major elements of what we consider to be wellness today. Exercise, yoga, meditation, diet, all kinds of things. And she takes them through the lens of her experience as a South Asian woman, growing up in, you know, relatively disadvantaged situations, and how she eventually was exposed to these different ideas, what her access or lack thereof to them was like, what her experiences with them are, how she understands, especially the elements of wellness that we have, you know, ported over from the East, co-opted, changed in many ways, commercialized in many ways in the West. And it's super interesting, just so, so much to think about. It gave me, I think I'm going to be thinking about it for a really long time. I don't know what I was expecting going into it. I think I was expecting a little bit more straightforward narrative nonfiction of here is the state of these elements of wellness, right. Sort of where, how did they make it to the U.S.? How have we bastardized them? What have we done? Because they've all been bastardized and co-opted and commercialized. And having her voice a little more in there made it both more interesting. There was a lot to think about, and it was helpful to have the hook of a person's personal experience. But then also was maybe a little distancing from some of the bigger ideas. So. But very interesting, a lot to hold on to. But mostly I was in the woods, not reading.
Cool.
And yeah, that was, and trying to avoid the news, which I was unsuccessful in doing.
Well, there's no way to escape that particular wave. Let's see, what have I done? Well, I did something, I don't remember if I said, but I don't remember if I said I was in the middle of it last week with Jen, but in case I didn't, I did finish An Immense World by Ed Yong on audio. Let's just say I'll probably be talking about it in our Patreon moment here in a few minutes.
Great.
It's great. So I did finish that. I read Memphis by Tara Stringfellow and Walhalla by Nikki May last week. So debut novelists. I thought they were both really good. I think they both were very much debut novels, I have to say. You can kind of smell it. I mean, if I had to write a 500-word review, I could maybe tease it out. But both very promising. You know, the gold standard for me of debut novels anymore is Homegoing by Jesse of recent memory. It's not that. You could have told me that's her fourth novel. If asked to guess which novel, I would probably guess debut for both, but there's a lot there. I think one thing I've noticed, especially with debut novels, that it's, just one second, I'm sorry, but one thing about debut novels in contemporary settings, there's a lot of background and where everyone's from and what they're wearing and eating and where they, you know, where they went to school. And that they contrasted so forcefully with Aurora by David Koepp, which I talked about last week, which gets right into the action. Now it's an action thing, but I don't know, a lot of throat clearing, setting the table. And if I'm 37% into your book on my Kindle and the kind of the plot starting to get going just then, too late on the whole. Yeah. That's one thing I'll say.
I agree. I had read, I think I had read Memphis the week you were on vacation because I talked about it with Vanessa here. And I had, I really also really liked it. I think it's a really strong debut. And I hadn't articulated that about all of the scene setting. Memphis is such like a lush and interesting, rich place to set a story. But I wonder how much of that is, that trend is intentional and how much maybe is just happening as a result of a thing that a lot of authors, especially debut authors, are really crossing their fingers for now is a pickup by a big book club and maybe a movie deal. And I think Memphis already has a movie deal or a TV series deal. I can't remember which, but that kind of setting the scene makes sense to me if you're trying to set people up for watching an adaptation.
I guess so. But isn't the great hook of like a TV show at the end of episode one, you're like, there's a dead body or my mom is a con artist, you know, whatever else it might be to get you in the rest of the show. I feel like I'm in episode four with a lot of these and, you know, they've got a world they're trying to build and characters they really care about. I don't know. It was another one I read recently that's like this. I don't know if I mentioned on the show is Let's Not Do That Again by Grant Gynder, which is kind of a thriller, political, zany. I don't know. It has tonality all over the place, but I was well into it before like the body dropped. And I actually didn't know. It was kind of a swerve too as well. I'm not sure. Maybe it's my own reading experience. Maybe it's where I am right now, but I had kind of similar reaction to several novels in a row. It's not just these two of like, get to it a little bit, you know, back out, but like where, set the hook or, you know, tell a story rather than describing stuff is where I am a little bit.
What was Aurora about? I haven't
Aurora, yeah. So I tell Jen, I blew through it one sitting on a plane, 5.5 hour flight, perfect plane ride. So David Koepp is a screenwriter. I think his most well-known, he might have written like The Dark Knight Returns or something like that. I don't have it in front of me right now, so I apologize if I'm wrong. But a screenwriter for sure. But it's, I would describe it as like a little bit of, it's somewhere between The Martian and Station 11 in tone and stakes. Like there's a giant solar flare. I don't know exactly what it's called. I think a solar flare is close enough for us non-astronomers. That knocks out all the power, almost all the power in the world for like 3 months, 3 or 4 months. So it's not an apocalypse, but it's also not a bad haircut, if you hear what I'm saying, in terms of stakes, right? Yeah. It's also not one guy on Mars. And I think it's both, it's not The Road, but it's also not, well, I don't know, Station 11 is pretty tough, but this is a long time after. It's not quite as dark. There's a lot of how are we going to get through this. There's some plot. I thought it was great. It was picked up for a huge, I'm sure it's going to be made into a Netflix series. Maybe even wrote it in lieu of a screenplay or a treatment to have something to both publish and then take out. But I thought it was really good to read at the other. I'm in the middle of one on audio right now that I wish I was done with for today because I've got a lot to go, but it's Easy Beauty. And let's see, let me make sure I get the author's name right because I don't want to mess this up. Easy Beauty by Chloe Cooper Jones. And it's a memoir. And she is, we pick up with her, and I don't know where it ends. We pick up with her where she's in the middle of a philosophy PhD program. And she's already gotten an English PhD. So let's say that writing is not the problem with this book. There isn't a problem with this book, but this is a sentence book as well as a. And she, and it's very interesting. And she doesn't get into it for a while. And I think this is one of those points where it was held because she knows where the interest is going to be and people are going to have the question. She has a visible physical disability. And that's part of the story. but we really don't know what it is until, let's see, I'm now 44% of the way into the book, and only recently have the specifics been given, because I think she's talking about being defined by the disability, and wants to withhold that so that you get a sense of her character and where she's come from and where she is in her own emotional state, you know, her wholeness as a person, before being defined as a condition that I think broadly falls, well, I'm not going to say. It's really good. It's really well written. It's the kind of book I'm glad I'm reading now. I'm not sure if it gets published 10 or 15 years ago, to be honest with you. Mm-hmm. And that's not the book's fault. It's the industry's fault. But there's not many books I've read like this. You know, it's bordering on the educated H and for Hawk quality of memoir.
Ooh,
about something I don't know much about. But there's a lot of the flight left, Rebecca. I don't know how it's going to land. I know the you know, things can go sideways or stagnate or something else can happen too. But I'm very, very cautiously buying stock in Easy Beauty by Chloe Cooper Jones to be one of the books we remember from this year. So that's my recent reading and listening. I think that's our show. If you're not already signed up for the Book Riot Patreon, you're going to get to hear me really wring my hands about narrowing my list that no one has given me the number of chits I can use, but I am worried about it anyway. As always, you can find the show notes to this and all back episodes of the Book Riot podcast at bookriot.com/listen. Do you have candidates for Book of the Year? If I'm missing something obvious, I'm really not right now talking about the Crawdads Ends With Us books. I think that's a phenomenon. I'm going to put those all together in the TikTok phenomenon. Mm-hmm. But I'm talking about, we're looking at the Goodreads books of 2022 and 20 years. And what do we think we're going to be trying to decide between for 1, 2, 3, and 4? That's kind of where I'm leaning towards. That's what I find more interesting, I should say, Rebecca, at
Same.
This point. So that's it. We'll talk to y'all later. And I'm now already nervous. Nervous about what's about to happen. I feel very, I'm very trepidatious at this point.
I can't wait.
All right. Talk to you later.